Today on the 21st Show, the late film critics Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert created a television show that made them household names and made their two thumbs up a coveted endorsement in Hollywood. But author and film critic Matt Singer says their influence and legacy extends far beyond their famous digits. He looks at Siskel and Ebert's outsized role in Hollywood history in his new book, Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. I'm Brian Mackey with Matt Singer for The Hour, today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Happy New Year. Welcome to 2024. That theme song you just heard is from the long-running TV show hosted by Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert. It went by several different names over the years: Sneak Previews, At the Movies, and ultimately just Siskel and Ebert. And those shows made the men household names, a level of fame enjoyed by very few people whose day job remained writing for newspapers. Beyond celebrity, they were also Hollywood kingmakers, championing movies, directors, and actors whose work they enjoyed. Their rise, influence, and legacy is the subject of a new book by Matt Singer called Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. Singer is himself a film critic and the editor of the website ScreenCrush.com. I originally spoke with Matt back in November, and we'll be spending our entire program today listening back to that conversation. Because our program's on tape, we're not taking your calls, but let us know what you think. Give us a thumbs up or thumbs down by emailing doc@21stshow.org. Matt, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We already heard from some of you by text today. Marianne in Champaign said, I could do a show with my memories of Siskel and Ebert all by myself. Started watching when I lived in Chicagoland. Loved the very intelligent approach and admired Ebert's ability to say, if you like XYZ, you will like this movie, even if he didn't like it. All right, Matt, so Siskel and Ebert both grew up in Illinois. Siskel in Chicago, Ebert in Urbana. And they went to the movies much like any other kid growing up in post-war America. Then they would ultimately become these like ultra famous film critics, but they didn't really start out on that path as a career. How did they end up as film critics?
Well, as you're kind of saying, they sort of circuitously, yeah, they did not grow up like the people who wound up watching their show like me grew up going, I someday would love to be a film critic. They had totally different ideas as kids about what they might want to be and different paths to getting the jobs. Ebert, you know, he was always interested in writing and, you know, was writing for newspapers, making up his own newspaper in his house when he was a little kid using like a toy printing press. He worked for the local paper in Urbana while he was still in high school. Then he ran the Daily Illini. So he had this really strong journalism background. And then he actually was studying English, getting his PhD in Chicago at the University of Chicago. And he just really needed a job to help pay the bills and got a job as a reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times. And then their film critic retired. Eleanor Keene was the name of the woman who was the film critic at the time. And the editors were looking for a replacement. One of the publicists for the Hollywood studios in Chicago liked something Ebert had written about a movie, or he had written a feature or an interview or something that they liked, and said, you should give that guy the job. He's good. And that was it. That's how he got the job. He certainly didn't set out to do it. Siskel, you know, he discovered journalism later. It wasn't like he grew up loving newspapers, wanting to be a newspaper man. He, you know, when he was younger, he thought he might be a lawyer. He really only discovered his love of journalism when he was in the Army Reserve and kind of was forced into doing that as opposed to doing other menial tasks. He could, you know, drive a truck, he said, or he was offered, you know, to learn how to do like pay stubs and newspaper stuff. And he said, I'll take that. And he kind of fell in love with it. And then when he got out of the army, pretty much just walked in off the street to the Chicago Tribune with a resume and got a job. And then sort of similarly to Ebert, he was there when their film critic didn't retire, but was leaving for a fellowship at Harvard, a gentleman by the name of Clifford Terry. And the Tribune was originally planning to just kind of have people fill in while he was gone. And just whoever is around this week, you can do the reviews. And Siskel thought he did like movies and had written a few pieces sort of about the world of entertainment and movies. And he thought, you know, I could do this job and I want that job. And he supposedly wrote a letter to the, you know, the editor who looked oversaw that position at the paper and said, you know, your idea isn't great having replacements. Just give me the job and I'll do it better. And he slipped it under the editor's door at night and left and assumed he wouldn't hear anything. But supposedly the next day when he came in, they called him into a meeting and said, all right, you got the job. And it sounds fanciful, but, you know, years later, someone went into Gene Siskel's personnel file at the Tribune and found the letter he had written that that really did happen. And that was it. And once they got the jobs, they pretty much did not leave those positions for the rest of their lives as the critics for the Tribune and the Sun-Times. Siskel eventually did kind of get moved over to like a more of a columnist position. It's a long story, but yeah, that was how they kind of got those jobs. It was not like their lifelong ambitions. They were kind of in the right place at the right time.
And at a time of generational change in Hollywood and the critical establishment, right? You had people like, I think it was at Bowsley, Crothers at the New York Times, who really just didn't get the new generation of movies coming out, like Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, things like that.
That's right. Yeah, this is the late 1960s we're talking about for both of them. Ebert started 2 years earlier than Siskel. But yes, it was that period, you know, that we now kind of refer to as the new Hollywood era. The studios were kind of in rough shape, and for the first time in really decades, they were kind of inviting new ideas, new filmmakers, young people, and they were doing some really interesting, experimental, funky movies all within the studio system. These were not like independent. These were made at the big major studios. They were so desperate for hits and so sort of struggling to connect with younger audiences. They were like sort of grasping at straws. And yes, there was this kind of old guard of criticism, especially at newspapers. Bosley Crowther was the film critic at the New York Times at the time. And just the name, I mean, no offense to anyone out there listening who's named Bosley, but Bosley Crowther, it's like hard to imagine someone with that name being less than like 60 years old. It just sounds like an old person name. But yes, he gave a very negative review to Bonnie and Clyde, and eventually kind of lost his job over it. Now, that's not like official, but the kind of the conventional wisdom is that he had been at that job for something like 40 years or something outrageous. And the Times got such a negative response to that review. And he actually wrote a second piece doubling down that he eventually was replaced within a year of filing that review. It might have only been a matter of a month or two. So, yeah, newspapers were looking for new blood, and it did help that Ebert and Siskel were both young men at the time. That absolutely helped them. Today, you know, if you were hiring the new film critic for a major metropolitan newspaper, I mean, you might not be hiring a critic at all, but if you were, yeah, you certainly wouldn't go to like some 23-year-old kid and say, okay, you've got the job. You would probably look for some really experienced person who had written about movies for years. That's not what they wanted, and that's not what they got in Siskel and Ebert. They were both young men at the time.
And they both make a mark. Ebert wins a Pulitzer Prize in the mid-70s, the first for a film critic and the last for like another quarter century, I think, for film criticism. And then the local PBS station, WTTW, calls them in to do a pilot TV show. How did that go?
Not well. It did not go well the first time. You can find, you know, it and some of the early episodes online, and it is sort of astonishing to look at them now and say, wow, how did this turn into Siskel and Ebert, this thing that became so powerful, so influential, so popular? Because it took a little while for the show to find its footing. You know, they, as you mentioned, this is now the mid-1970s when the actual show starts. So they've been rivals and competitors for about 6 years by that point, from 1969 until 75. And really intense rivals. It's not like they see each other at screenings and they go, "Hey, Gene, how are you? Hey, Roger, good to see you." You know, Ebert would say later, years later, that in those 6 years, the two of them never had a meaningful conversation because they so intensely, if not disliked each other personally, just resented them and saw the other person as the enemy, as the competitor, as the person they had to beat. And they sort of did not care for each other. And they're thrown together at WTTW to do this show. And the pilot in the first few episodes, it took a while. Both of them had done a little bit of TV work, but, you know, certainly they were print journalists first. So they didn't know really how to write for television. They weren't particularly great performing on television. All of these things had to kind of come about gradually. And they also had to sort of figure out how to take that rivalry from off camera and figure out a way to make it work for them on camera, which was also a process.
Yeah. Fun, just a personal aside here. You mentioned the rivalry between a Tribune person and a Sun-Times person. I got my start in the State House press room here in Illinois back in the mid-aughts. And at the time, the Tribune and the Sun-Times had bureaus here. And I got to say, I'm not sure that I ever saw their two reporters. I mean, they weren't, you know, bitter or nasty to each other, but they really didn't interact much, although they were friendly to everyone else in the press room. So that that Tribune Sun-Times thing, that is real and deep. I think that is ingrained, or at least it was at the time. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Matt Singer, who is a film critic and the author most recently of Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. Kay on line 4 calling from Champaign, Illinois. Kay, thank you for calling in.
Sure. I just wanted to share an opportunity I had to have a conversation with Roger Ebert when I was in grad school in the late 80s. The U of I provided an opportunity for grad school students to meet with famous alums. And I was at this tent party, and I looked over and noticed that Roger Ebert was standing all by himself. And I thought, well, I better get over there and make him feel welcome. And I had read his column on Shirley MacLaine, luckily, the day before. So we started talking about Shirley MacLaine. And then we both agreed that she was a very smart woman. And then we moved on to talking about her brother, Warren Beatty. And this conversation went on for about 20 minutes. And about halfway through, I thought to myself, I cannot believe this is happening. He was a very gracious, kind man to spend that kind of time with a grad student who really didn't know anything, and he was such a giant.
Amazing. Well, thank you for sharing that, Kay. I really appreciate you calling in. You know, that reminds me of text message we got this morning as well from Don, also in Champaign, who just mentioned that a friend of his actually grew up next door to Roger and spurred his own desire to review movies. And Don also said he wound up religiously watching the Thumb Brothers. I once saw Siskel at a Madonna concert and gave Ebert a key to the city of Champaign. I suspect that may be Don Gerard, former mayor of Champaign, writing in there. But, you know, Matt, 3 minutes until we need to take a break, but something jumped out at me that Kay said, which was Ebert was standing alone. And this is a theme that you come back to sometimes throughout the book, that this is a man who felt alone and isolated and sort of stood apart for much of his life.
Yes, he did write that and talk about that sometimes. There were these two sort of sides, which I think that story kind of illustrates, is that, yes, he sometimes felt like his purest self or his truest self was like a guy sitting at a cafe alone in a country, you know, a foreign country where he didn't know anyone, and he was just sitting and watching the world kind of go by. He wrote that several times. He wrote it in a column and then republished or expanded on those ideas in his memoir. And yes, that was like one side of himself, and, you know, probably was useful as a journalist, because a certain amount of being a journalist and being a film critic is observation and watching and observing and being attentive to things that you see. And then on the other hand, he did have this other side where people told me he was a fabulous storyteller, that he would regale people with these stories when he would come into the Sun-Times newsroom. He would be standing in the, you know, amongst all the other desks, and he would just kind of hold court, tell a story. And within a few minutes, a whole crowd would be around him, and he would be doing voices, and, you know, that he could, he was a real, you know, a great storyteller in that sense. And you also see that in his film criticism, what a gifted writer he was. And he was so evocative with his words. He could really bring you into his sort of perspective. He had that ability to do that. You know, it really speaks to what made him special, is that he had that ability to observe and stand at a remove, but then he could also kind of bring you inside his perspective. That's not easy to do, especially to be able to do both of those things so well. He really had sort of this very unique mix of traits that made him especially kind of gifted to write film criticism the way he did, and I think is one of the reasons he did become such a huge figure in the world of criticism.
Yeah, and I often thought, I read him a lot actually in print in the Sun-Times back in his final years, and then he created that blog, and what a great general columnist he would have been. It's almost like I wonder if he, you know, and he talked at some point in his life about maybe he wouldn't do movie reviews forever. Of course, I think the TV show probably changed that calculus for him financially and otherwise. All right, we need to take a quick break. We're listening back to my November conversation with Matt Singer, film critic and author of Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Change Movies Forever. We're going to continue talking about Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel and their TV program and how it changed the world of movies after the break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. The theme song for the original iteration of Siskel and Ebert's television review program. If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking with Matt Singer, who himself is a film critic, editor at ScreenCrush.com, and the author of a new book called Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. Siskel and Ebert, of course, both Illinois men. Siskel was a reporter at the, or I should say a film critic at the Chicago Tribune. Ebert was the critic at the Chicago Sun-Times. They began their program on PBS in the mid-1970s. Eventually in the 80s, they went syndicated nationally and continued through the 90s until Siskel's death, and Ebert continued beyond that until his own health challenges prevented him from returning to the show. Matt, I want to talk a little bit about, I think it's interesting, and you spend some time in the book talking about what the information environment, you might say, was like for people who liked movies back when this show came on the air, right? I think, you know, today you can get teasers and trailers and reviews and interviews, and your colleagues make breakdowns of teasers and trailers on YouTube. I mean, you can find all this content about movies. And that was not the case for a lot of Siskel and Ebert's run. Talk about what the information environment was like for movie fans back then.
It really was a different world. I mean, especially if you talk about the mid-1970s when the show starts. I mean, forget about getting information on movies. It's hard to get information on anything at a, you know, certainly at the pace that we get it now, and at the ease. You know, obviously they're working for newspapers. Newspapers are huge, and there's television. There's, you can watch the news on TV, but you know, we're decades from really everyone having a computer, much less having YouTube and Google and all those sorts of tools at their disposable, you know, at their fingertips instantly. It really was a totally different universe. And so, you know, when we're talking about, well, the pilot for the show wasn't very good, and a very natural question to ask is like, well, if the show wasn't very good in the beginning, and Siskel and Ebert hadn't gotten the hang of it right away, like, what was the appeal? Why did the show continue? And it, I think a large part it was because people were very interested in movies. Movies were even more central to popular culture than they are now. And it was difficult to find clips and information about what was coming to theaters. And this show provided that. Every week, if you tuned in, you were going to find out about what the new movies in town were, at least in Chicago, and you were going to get to see clips from those movies. You were going to hear interesting discussion about those movies. And then as the years went on, they expanded and they started talking about what was on home video, and they started doing theme episodes that were about issues in the movies. So it became this incredible weekly, almost a news magazine about the world of movies. And it was a great place to go if you were a movie lover to find out what was going on in pop culture and movie culture.
I can't remember if this was in the book or I heard you talking about it in another interview, but just talk about how they would actually get the clips, because you can't just go download them like we can today.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, it's definitely in the book. And I probably have talked about it in interviews because it is kind of wild. It, you know, we're talking about the 70s into the 80s, and movies are still projected on film, giant cans of film. And it's so long ago that movie studios were not automatically sending film critics, film journalists, what are now called electronic press kits, which are just sort of digital files of scenes from the movies, trailers, images, things that they can use in their reviews, in their coverage to kind of augment their print coverage or their TV coverage. That did not really exist at the time, or certainly was not a widespread practice. And so for the show, which clips from these movies was so essential to the show, they would have to make the clips themselves. They would go to either their press screenings, or they would sometimes go to an actual theater where a movie was being publicly shown, and they would go, Gene and Roger would go to see the movies, and they would bring someone from the staff with them, a producer, a production assistant, and they would, it was their job to take notes. They would call out during the movie, this scene or that scene, and they would have to write down the time codes where they were in the movie, keep track of those times, and then after the movie, they would have to go get the reels of film, the physical cans of film, which are, you know, 20, 30 pounds each, and lug them to a place where they could essentially copy just those scenes. Then they would have to bring the cans back to the original theater. It was a whole process. And then those clips would then wind up in the show. And it was a very time-consuming, labor-intensive process. But again, at this time, it gave the show this very unique selling point, which was clips from these movies that you're probably not going to see anywhere else.
There were critics, film critics, who thought Siskel and Ebert were kind of, what would you say, dumbing down the discourse on cinema. You write about an article in the influential Film Comment magazine lamenting the sorry state of criticism. The headline on that was All Thumbs, which was obviously a sly reference to Siskel and Ebert. Do you think Siskel and Ebert degraded the critical conversation on movies?
Well, I'm the wrong person to ask, because I was one of those, you know, young people in the early 90s who was watching the show and discovering film criticism through the show. And that's sort of also my defense, is that, you know, certainly the level of criticism on Siskel and Ebert was not going to be the same thing you were going to get in a magazine like Film Comment, a magazine I have enjoyed many times in my life. But, you know, I think both have their place. And I do think that Siskel and Ebert, you know, they did, because they became so popular and so influential, they, I think, understandably, there were people who were skeptical about the show. And, you know, perhaps some, I'm not saying in the case of that particular Film Comment article, but perhaps there was some jealousy as well. I think that that's probably reasonable to assume in some cases. But I think ultimately, a lot of the complaints about the show, first of all, now they seem absurd when you compare the world of today to what they were doing at the time. But I also think A lot of it was just based on the fact that the movie studios began using two thumbs up as a selling point in ads, and they would put it on posters and they would put it in trailers. And so, sure, if that's all you think about with Siskel and Ebert, that certainly is not a very elaborate, very detailed, nuanced degree of film criticism. But on the show, if you watch the show, yeah, there were two thumbs up and all of that at the end of every episode for a minute or two. But every movie got a discussion, a debate, a conversation. And sometimes those debates and discussions, you know, they got extremely interesting. And they weren't always just about the movies. They sometimes debated philosophy, religion, spirituality, politics, 100 different things. Or just debating, like, the very nature of film criticism and how to judge movies, because Siskel and Ebert both saw movies very differently, and they saw the job very differently, and their approaches to criticism were very different. And that was all reflected in the show. And if you go back and watch it now, I don't think what you see is a dumbed down film criticism. I think what you see is this wonderful gateway to film criticism for a mass audience to discover movies, to discover film conversations and film literacy. And I think the show is incredibly valuable in that regard.
And you also see two guys who, despite their rivalry, maybe seem to actually enjoy working together and enjoy the fight. And it was just good TV, right? And it's actually, I think it was Richard Corliss in that article you cite who called Siskel and Ebert a sitcom, essentially, right? Starring two guys who live in a movie theater and argue all the time, Oscar Ebert and Felix Siskel. And that does bring us to their relationship. They really did get on each other's nerves. They had a lot of petty fights over the years. What was that like for the people who had to work with them?
Well, it could sometimes be a little frustrating. Certainly, I spoke to a lot of people who worked on the show through the years. And yes, they had a lot of stories about, as you put it, petty fights that would happen from time to time, even as their personal relationship off camera did improve and did get better through the years. They still had the ability, if one or the other perceived that they were being slighted in some way, to have some sort of argument about it. That did happen. And I guess at times it could make things a little difficult to work on the show. But what I found when I was interviewing people was, it wasn't like they said, oh, they fought all the time, it was a miserable experience. It was more like they would say, yeah, they fought all the time, but we really loved working on the show, because as much as they could sometimes bicker, like, it also was this place where it was pretty unique in that it was this forum for movie love, movie discussion, movie debate. Every week there were new movies to discuss, and, you know, quite often movies that they championed, you know, became hits in large part because of their championing them. You know, little movies, documentaries, foreign films, independent films, when they would be highlighted and recommended on Siskel and Ebert, that often really helped the fortunes of the movies and the people that made them. And I think the people who worked on the show took pride in that, just like I know that Siskel and Ebert took pride in that as well. So, you know, sometimes there were issues that cropped up between the two of them that had to be dealt with. I know in the book I've mentioned at one point they fought so regularly about, you know, what to get for lunch, because, you know, one would want yeah. one thing and one would want the other, that they essentially had to order the exact same lunch every single week so that there would not be an argument about it, because just to kind of head that off, there would be no debate. We would just get the same thing every time. Things like that would happen. But, you know, I didn't get the sense talking to people that they were mean bosses or they were hard to work for, that, you know, perhaps they maybe were hard to work with, each other found them hard to work with. But to the people they worked, you know, that worked for the show, they had very positive things to say about the experience.
You mentioned the tuna sandwich. My favorite example from the book was they both flew in, like, what, business class or first class, but they had these particular ideas that the one seat on the left on the first row and on the right in the third row were the best seats, and who got the first row and who got the third row, and, like, even something like that, or who got to sit next to Letterman when they would go on, you know, a late night talk show. And in fact, we actually have a clip of a fight that they got into on Letterman. This is an argument over who got to tell an anecdote. Let's roll tape on that.
There was a story about, I guess you were interviewing, no, it was you. You were interviewing Jack Lemmon.
We were both interviewing Jack Lemmon.
Yeah.
We're seated at the table, and Jack Lemmon.
Hold on.
Here we go.
Wait a minute.
We're both interviewing.
Are you going to tell the engine here?
We're both interviewing Jack Lemmon.
Wait. Time out. I'm the butt of this story, and
yes.
It's always funnier if the guy tells the story that is the butt of it rather than the other guy telling it on the first guy. And besides, you can't tell good jokes.
I can tell it real
slap
quick.
Slap him, Roger.
No.
Just go ahead and whack him across.
Let the audience decide. Okay.
And I'll ask the audience which joke was funnier, the box of chocolates jokes or the hanging up and
okay,
down
now,
by the ankle?
I'd like to make my statement now. Okay.
Girls, please settle down.
You could almost feel the discomfort of the audience there because that was real, right? I mean, that was a real argument they were having on national television.
Yeah, so that story is detailed in the book. That's a really interesting episode of The Late Show. You can find that one on YouTube. And yes, Roger later wrote an interesting column about that appearance where he revealed that essentially they were kind of set up to get into this argument. And I don't mean it was a fake argument. What I mean was, you know, when you go on a talk show like a Letterman or a Leno or a Jimmy Fallon or whatever it is, there's always a pre-interview where a producer asks you questions, wants to know what you want to talk about, looks for things that can be discussed on the show. And in each of their separate pre-interviews, both Gene and Roger were told, Dave wants to ask about that story, the Jack Lemmon story. Be ready to tell it and make sure you are the one to tell the story. And so that's what happened there, is that he prompts them and they both want to tell the story, and they immediately start, as you heard, really yelling at each other and fighting over who gets to tell the story. Now, anyone else in that position at a certain point would go, okay, Gene, or okay, Roger, you just tell the story. They would give up. But that is part of the magic of Siskel and Ebert, is that they would not just let the other one win. Their whole on-screen and maybe a lot of their off-screen relationship was based on the idea that they would never let the other one win. And so that is the result, is that they are just so fighting tooth and nail to tell this story. And it leads to, you say it's a little uncomfortable, but I don't think Dave is uncomfortable. He's really relishing it. And if you
he's a performance artist, right? He loves it.
Yeah, he's loving it. And if you keep watching, if you go and find the clip and keep watching, he tells the story, he gets a huge laugh. He being Dave, then interrupts and tells the story, gets a huge laugh. And as they were leaving, as Gene and Roger were leaving the Ed Sullivan Theater that night, they said that they were, they were a little, this is now Roger's recollection later in this column. He said, oh, we felt a little bad because we got so worked up. And as you said, it could have maybe been a little uncomfortable because it was such a real, authentic fight. And as they were leaving, one of the producers of The Late Show came up to them and said, guys, that was a great segment. And it was. And you see that is what they brought, both on Siskel and Ebert and when they did these talk show appearances, which they were regular guests on all these shows and very popular doing that. And that was what they brought, that authenticity. You knew, whether in a review or on a talk show or anywhere, when these guys showed up, they were going to be real. You know, so much of showbiz is phony, especially on those talk shows. It's all about everyone likes everyone. Everyone's new movie is the best movie that's ever been made. Every clip looks fantastic. Siskel and Ebert showed up and they told you what they thought. And they said, that movie is bad. Don't go see it. You know, if that's what they thought, they would say that. They would say it on The Tonight Show sitting next to the star of the movie, which is just not done. And that was the same energy they brought to their reviews. You might not agree with either of them or both of them when they were doing their reviews on their show, but you always believed they were telling you what they genuinely thought.
We need to take a break in about a minute here. We did get a caller, didn't want to go on air, but a quick question. Rich in Champaign wants to know, how can you see old episodes of Siskel and Ebert? Is it all basically YouTube at this point?
There's a few places online you can find them. There's a lot on YouTube. Yes, that's the best place to start. There's also a really good, it's not an official website, but there's a website, I believe it's SiskelEbert.org. It's just like a fan website that has a lot of episodes. They're gathered there by year, by era of the show. They also have clips from interviews with them and talk show appearances and other random things that they did through the years. And that's a great website to look at as well. But yeah, unfortunately, there isn't an official website for the show, like a full archive year by year, episode by episode. The vast majority of stuff is available online right now, but we're still waiting for like the official website and archive, which I know if it existed, I would be thrilled to be able to look at any review. Yeah. And
maybe Chaz Ebert will make that happen at some point. But we're gonna take a break. When we return, more with Matt Singer. The book is Opposable Thumbs. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
When it comes to talking with their thumbs, our first guests are the best in the business. During their 19 years together, they have reviewed almost 4,000 films. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Siskel and Ebert of movies, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert. Here they are.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. I selected that clip from Letterman because I think it just does a good job summing up the vast breadth of the work that Siskel and Ebert did together. I mean, they were obviously independent film critics, Siskel at the Chicago Tribune, Ebert at the Sun-Times, but in their shows together is where they really made their mark on our culture and on Hollywood. Sneak previews at the movies, Siskel and Ebert. All that is the subject of the new book, Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. It's by Matt Singer, who himself is a film critic, editor of the website ScreenCrush.com. He's with us now. Matt, you hinted at this earlier. I want to dig a little deeper into their influence in Hollywood. You talked about how they could champion movies that were maybe overlooked. I mean, in fact, Ebert's own film festival in later years was called the Overlooked Film Festival, at least when it started. Now it's Ebert Fest. But talk about some of the filmmakers who you say owe their careers to Siskel and Ebert's support. Who would you put in that category?
Well, one person who said that to me directly was Errol Morris, the filmmaker documentarian. I interviewed him for the book, and, you know, he said, I don't think I would have a career if not for Siskel and Ebert. He was referring to specifically the way that they kind of championed and discovered one of his very first movies, Gates of Heaven, which had played at a few film festivals. It played at the New York Film Festival, in fact, but it had played there during a newspaper strike and hadn't gotten a lot of coverage and attention. It kind of came and went. And then Siskel and Ebert saw the movie, and Errol Morris told me he didn't even know how they saw it. He does not remember. He has no idea how or where they saw the movie. He just knows that he tuned in one week, and they were talking about his movie in glowing terms. And then they kept talking about it, which was something that they would do. You know, if they really loved a movie, they wouldn't just review it once. They would keep bringing it up. It would appear on their year-end best-of lists. They would do episodes called Buried Treasures, where they would re-recommend movies that hadn't been big hits at the box office. And they threw it in there. And then they just kept, any chance they could, they would keep mentioning the movie. And he says that all of a sudden, the movie started getting attention. And he says that Errol Morris told me, you know, if not for that, he didn't think he would have a career as a filmmaker. They gave him hope, was another phrase he told me, because they sort of got what he was doing and wanted to do at a time where it seemingly very few other people were getting it. And, you know, Errol Morris has a brand new movie on Apple that just came out called The Pigeon Tunnel. Another documentary. He's still making the kinds of movies he wants to make today, all these decades later. And I think that's really like kind of a lovely testament to the show and to Siskel and Ebert's like kind of continuing legacy, is that, he's still doing it, Errol Morris is, and I think that's great. And we could come up with a lot of other examples. I talked to other filmmakers. You know, Steve James is another one, the director of Hoop Dreams, who really credited the show with helping to launch that movie and bringing it to a wider audience. A 3-hour documentary about basketball shot on videotape at a time when it was very hard to get a movie shot on video into movie theaters. And their review, early review, before it had even played at Sundance or during the Sundance Film Festival, really, it was a watershed moment for that movie, really. It really suddenly, like, changed that movie's fortunes forever. So there's lots of other examples.
Yeah, Hoop Dreams, of course, considered a modern classic. It's gotten the Criterion Collection treatment and all the rest. You know, I want to spend in the time we have left. They were so prescient about a lot of things, right? They you write about them reviewing music videos sometimes in the early 80s, and they could see that that's the direction that film would be going in the 90s. There's this amazing episode called The Future of Movies in 1990, where they interview Spielberg and George Lucas and Scorsese, and it seems to like predict HDTV and direct to streaming movies and a lot that we are living with now. I want to spend the rest of our time, though, thinking about their role in film criticism and film culture. And there's one more clip I want to play. This is from the early days of their partnership, 1977. They just show a clip of Star Wars. It's the scene where Han Solo and Luke Skywalker are escaping from the Death Star and the Millennium Falcon. They're in those sort of World War II style gun turrets fighting off TIE fighters. And this is how they react to that scene. Let's listen to that.
You know, I've seen the picture three times, and that sequence more than that. And every time I see that little fighting sequence, I think I figured out the secret of at least that chunk of the movie, and that is, that looks exactly like what happens at a pinball game that kids love. We're seeing things blow up, and I think the way this movie is shot different ways, quick action like that, it's like you're putting every person as a pinball player who walks into the theater.
Maybe that's why people can see it a dozen times or two dozen times, because it doesn't matter that you know the story. You still have the sound and light, the effects, the explosions, the dogfight in outer space. It's just a never-ending visual delight. It's a movie that will last for years.
Yeah, the only thing I'm worried about is it's so successful and so mindless fun that I hope Hollywood doesn't forget that there are people who like to see serious pictures, too.
You know, what do you think of Siskel's concern there? This was the start of the blockbuster era, and now we've seen, maybe it's even come full circle, right? Because now we're almost post-blockbuster. We see Disney taking things that should have been movies and making them into Disney Plus series in their Star Wars and, you know, the Marvel, things like that. What do you talk about their prescience for the direction of the sort of broad currents of Hollywood?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating clip, isn't it? And very interesting to hear Siskel saying, yeah, boy, this movie is so popular. I really hope Hollywood doesn't take the wrong lessons from it. Spoiler alert, Gene. Yeah. I hate to be the bearer of bad news. Yes, they were very, I mean, that's a great example, too, of like, you're not just getting, well, this is a good movie, thumbs up sort of criticism. Here they're talking about, they're thinking about, why is this movie so popular? This is like clearly a review from after the movie has already been out for a while. And so they're able to kind of dig in a little deeper. And they're now talking about the appeal of the movie and why it is such a hit and thinking about why it has this impact and what its legacy is going to be. I mean, that's a great example of how the show went way, way beyond just saying, oh, this is good, thumbs up, or this is bad, thumbs down. And they were very prescient at times. I mean, it was fascinating to watch hundreds of episodes of the show while doing the research for this book. Perhaps some other person, that might sound like a chore to sit for months on end rewatching Siskel and Ebert. To me, it was absolutely delightful and really enlightening, because certainly I had seen a lot of the show, but there were so many episodes I hadn't seen or had forgotten. And to see the way, you know, by watching the show, you're really watching Hollywood evolve from the mid-1970s to the late 1990s. If you want a snapshot of the American movie industry at any point during this period, find the Siskel and Ebert episode from that particular week and just watch it, and you will learn something. I guarantee it. You will find out something about the way of the movie world in 1978 or 1992 or 1985. It's this great series of time capsules of what was going on in the movie business. And yeah, you do get to see it evolve and see how they react to, you know, the emergence of home video is something that they were talking about and prescient about. When the show started, VHS tapes didn't even exist. And so they got to witness the rise of home video, of VHS, of Laserdisc, of DVD. And they made some interesting predictions about those formats and how they were going to change or not change the movie world. And a lot of them pretty much came true. And by the early 90s, there's episodes of the show where they're predicting high-definition television and movies being streamed into people's homes and being viewed instantly, and predicting how that would affect which movies were going to be made. And to a large degree, they were right about all of it, and they really were predicting the world of movies that we live in right now. It's kind of astonishing, some of those things that they predicted with almost complete accuracy.
Yeah, it really is striking. All right, one more call we can get in. I think Dave is calling from Carterville on line four. Dave, thanks for calling in.
Hi, enjoying the show very much. I was a high school English teacher and was teaching a nonfiction writing class at one point and was using Ebert's reviews, one of his yearbooks, and had a lot of fun presenting his reviews as examples of good writing, and had a lot of fun doing that. The kids enjoyed it because they might have seen some of the same movies. And one thing that stood out to me was his leads. He just was a wonderful writer as far as using a lead that would really work and set up the rest of the review.
Yeah, that's great memory, Dave. Thanks so much for sharing that. I guess he was a true newspaperman through and through, and knew how to write a good lead. You know, Matt, just a few minutes left in our time together. It's interesting to me. You see Ebert and Siskel's influence going beyond Hollywood, right? And in a style of television that we still see all over the place today, from cable news to ESPN. Draw that connection for us.
Sure. Well, absolutely. Yes. There isn't a Siskel and Ebert on the air right now, on television right now, about movies, but that format that they pioneered, absolutely. I don't think it's hard to see its influence in other areas of television. And as you said, in politics, in sports talk, I mean, it feels like in recent years, all of politics and sports talk on television, that's all it is people sort of debating and arguing all day long about these subjects. And I think that actually their influence on movie talk continues as well, even though their show is over and there isn't really a show like it on television. I mean, how many film podcasts and YouTube channels that are devoted to movies are just about people talking to, you know, film critics or film lovers debating a movie or debating a subject from the world of movies? I would scarcely imagine the vast majority of all of them are that, and that all stems from them. They and the show really was the first place where film criticism was transformed from a monologue, one person talking, into a dialogue, into two people debating and discussing. And it was extremely successful for them. And it hasn't really, nobody's been able to replace them on television. But I think what's evolved out of that for movies is, yeah, the world of podcasts and online discourse, where it's a lot of people who are having these sorts of conversations, maybe not quite so heated, and maybe they're a little longer than they were on Siskel and Ebert, where the reviews were generally about 5 minutes long or so. Podcasts tend to be an hour or more. But I do think what you see is sort of the their influence, all their fingerprints are all over those kinds of shows. And I certainly enjoy listening to them. I mean, it's never going to be the same as Siskel and Ebert, but I think if you enjoy hearing people talk about movies, there's more places to do that than there ever was before.
Yeah, I mean, you're being a little humble, right? Because you don't only listen to them, you were part of some of them. I still miss Streaming Video Unit, which has been, off the air or off the podcast feed for quite a while. But that was a great show that you did with Allison Wilmore. And yeah, I'm afraid that is the end of our time together today. So I'll just say the book is called Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. The author is Matt Singer. He's also the editor at ScreenCrush.com, where you can find his work today. Matt, great conversation. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
That was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We originally had that conversation with Matt Singer on the program in November. Coming up tomorrow, the writer Will Leach. He was born, raised, and educated in Central Illinois. He got famous for creating the sports website Deadspin, and today is writing novels. We'll listen back to my conversation with Will about his life, work, and the future of journalism. Before we go, will you consider joining our texting group? You put the public in public radio, and we love sharing your comments and questions on the show. Join by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, the word is TALK, and you send that to 217-803-0730. We appreciate hearing from you about our programs and your suggestions for future guests or things happening in your area that you think aren't getting enough attention. You can email us. The address is talk@21stshow.org. And you can find that address and every other way to contact us on our website, which again, 21stshow.org. We've got all of our past segments there, and you can find links to subscribe to our podcasts or look us up on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Kennedy Vincent, and Jose Zepeda. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.